I'm Peter Mudlin, and you are listening to Teacher's Lounge from WNIJ. And if this is your first time hearing our show, I've got great news. It's based on a really simple idea that we've all had teachers in our lives who helped us become who we are today. And every educator we have on the podcast, whether teacher, coach, or professor, is nominated by the folks who listen. So we want you to be a part of this show. So tell us about the educators who've inspired you and the folks in your community who you think deserve a spotlight. You can email us with your nominations at teacherslounge@niu.edu. And today on the show, it is my conversation with Joshua Stafford. He's the superintendent at the Vienna High School District down on the southern tip of Illinois, and we had a wide-ranging conversation. In about an hour, we talked about the history of education in America, standardized testing, school safety, his recent journey to Singapore through the Fulbright program, and a fateful trip to Haiti years ago that showed him why public education is a gift.
I said, Oscar, who are those kids? And he says, Josh, those are the kids who want to go to school, but they can't. And I'm like, huh? And so I said, Oscar, I don't understand. What do you mean? Explain this to me. He goes, well, our school's full, so there's no room for them here, and they can't afford the school fee. And I'm like, well, one, if your school's full, they just simply go down to the next school. He goes, there isn't another one. And I'm like, how much is the fee? And it was $21 for the whole year. And I'm like, so even if we could pay the fee, there's not room for them here. He goes, yeah. So that just, Peter, just one of those moments, pendulum shift moments.
We talk about all of that and much more. Truly one of my favorite conversations I've had in a while. You're not going to want to miss it. But before we get to our conversation, we have another education story we want to share. Nearly 100 Illinois high schools are part of an initiative to strengthen civics education. And I got to go to their annual conference to talk about how democracy schools can help when 3/4 of Americans think democracy itself is under serious threat. Intense polarization, wrenching political violence, AI breeding new modes of misinformation. What students see every day barely resembles what they traditionally read in a civics textbook. So it's time for a new way forward. That's according to Mary Ellen Daniels, longtime civics teacher and founder of Democracy Schools. And she believes their schools can meet the moment and be a model for kids and their communities.
This isn't just a social studies thing. This isn't just a citizenship test, but it's thinking about how all teachers and all adults in a building send messages about how our republic works.
Democracy Schools started 20 years ago with a few schools in the Chicago suburbs, and it's now a network of over 90 throughout the state. And it's also expanding out of Illinois. They're working with Wisconsin and Indiana to create programs, and the recent conference featured teachers from across the Midwest and as far as Hawaii, all looking to follow Illinois' lead in civics. So what exactly does a democracy school look like? Daniil says media literacy is crucial, and they also simulate democratic processes through things like the legislative semester class, where students act as lawmakers and pass bills.
Some of those tools are things like current and controversial issue discussions. How do we navigate some of these issues that divide us?
But it's not just teaching students how government works. It's about participating in government. Daniil says that while polarization is toxic nationally, locally, they can get to know decision makers and make their voice heard.
That's actually more real for kids. The local government that decides where the skate park is, that decides the policies at their schools.
In Western Illinois, Spoon River Valley has been a democracy school for 3 years, where Jennifer Burdett says it has transformed her classroom. Her students feel democracy by having a hand in their own school's budget process.
And the students got $2,000 to spend for the school district, and they had to vote on things. They led that whole initiative. They met with administration. They told administration what their thoughts were. And then ultimately, we put those into place. We have a coffee shop now that runs in our school because it was a student-created initiative.
Spoon River Valley is also on the cutting edge of Democracy School's next move, expanding to middle and elementary schools. With the emergence of AI and other new tech, Burdett's been helping teach media literacy to fifth graders.
It's a skill set that we have to explicitly teach, and we have to start it younger and younger because they're getting technology younger and younger.
Americans don't agree on much, but one thing just about everyone agrees on is that teaching students to be good citizens should be a priority.
civic knowledge is remarkably, you know, concerningly low, right? Where something like 3 in 10 people could pass the U.S. naturalization test.
That's Sean Healy. He presented at the conference and used to teach civics alongside Daniil's, but now works on policy with iCivics, which creates civics games and activities used by millions of students in the U.S.
We really hollowed out civic education. Some of that happened during my time, right, particularly with No Child Left Behind and this kind of exclusive focus on reading and math. It crowded out everything else from the curriculum.
He's right. In the first 5 years after No Child Left Behind passed in 2002, across the country, schools slashed social studies and civics instruction by 32%, with some schools cutting it in half. That's according to a report from the Center on Education Policy. But Healy says it's improving. States are investing more in civics. 36 states, including Illinois, require a standalone high school course. And since 2018, he says 12 states have passed civics requirements for middle school. So just about everyone agrees we should teach students to be good citizens. But the question is, what exactly does that look like? Well, a survey from the University of Southern California shows most Americans believe students should learn about the Constitution, identifying false information online, finding community solutions, and debating opposing views, all principles of democracy schools. But Healy says that doesn't mean teaching civics is always easy.
If you go back a quarter century, teachers had a ton of autonomy in terms of how they taught civics. Now there is incredible scrutiny. So it's politically fraught in many places to teach civics nowadays.
Illinois State Superintendent Tony Sanders spoke at the conference, and he says it's harder to teach about elections when President Trump posts debunked election fraud conspiracies. And he worries it makes students lose even more trust in the democratic process.
There's never been a more important time in our history to be teaching civic education. I have a real fear that the rhetoric of election rigging and the rhetoric of, well, anything having to do with election, even having National Guard potentially coming into the city of Chicago or any state, and the effect that has on repressing votes.
The U.S. Department of Education recently announced a new America 250 Civics Education Coalition. Its launch video isn't as much about a lack of civic knowledge and engagement as it is about a lack of perceived patriotism in classrooms.
A great institution has been crumbled from within, overtaken by those who teach hatred for America, false revisionist history, and division.
The coalition's made up of right-wing groups like the Heritage Foundation and PragerU, and they say there'll be a speaking tour, student competitions, and teacher summits. And at the announcement of the coalition, Education Secretary Linda McMahon said she believes to teach civics is to teach students to love America. She cited a poll from this year stating that 41% of Gen Z say they're extremely or very proud to be an American.
Why aren't they proud to be Americans? It's because they don't know America. We haven't taught them about America. They don't know our history. They don't know the trials and tribulations that led to this being the most wonderful country on the face of the earth.
Here in Illinois, Democracy School's Mary Ellen Daniil says civics isn't a red or blue issue. She says their civics education work helps students engage in reflective patriotism.
Look honestly at some of our past failures, but also give kids those tools to reflect on how we've improved and how we can do better in the future.
And for all of Illinois' civics investment, is it working? Engaging in civics in your community is a lifelong mission, but how do they know that message is getting through to students? Sean Healy with iCivics says they worked with a research group a few years ago to figure out if Illinois' mandated high school civics courses were having an impact.
We found, for example, that young people that took this class were more likely to vote. They were more likely to discuss political issues. They were more likely to volunteer. So that is impact, right?
Healy says he thinks the country's probably as politically polarized as it's been since the Civil War. He and the people at Democracy Schools think that one of the main ways out of this is through stronger civics education. All right, now it's time for my conversation with Josh Stafford, superintendent at the Vienna High School District. And we start off chatting about just why our systems are set up the way they are.
I think it intrigues me the reason that we get to the places that we get to, right? I mean, I look at the history of just education in general, and you look at the state of Illinois has 852 school districts. You think, how in the world is it possible that we have 852 school districts in a state with 102 counties?
It's wild to me. And like, you're in one of those towns, right, that has multiple school districts, you know, per one community, right?
Yep. We still have six school districts in one county that's sparsely populated. And so really that goes back to this Massachusetts Bay Colony kind of way of thinking. And as the Puritan communities grew during that time, right pre-1776, we're talking like 1647, they passed a law in Massachusetts Bay Colony that said any community of 50 or more needed to establish a schoolhouse and pay a teacher. So they needed to pay for the teacher, for the schoolhouse, that type of thing, community of 50 or more. So that's what started the one-room schoolhouse movement, was really the 1647 Massachusetts Bay Colony law. And in our community, we used to have 70 one-room schoolhouses. My grandparents attended, right? Three of my four grandparents are still alive to this day, and they attended one-room schoolhouses in this community. So kind of interesting, right, that you go, we went from having 71 from one-room schoolhouses to now six different school campuses, if you will, in the county. So the count has shrunk greatly, but there's the history of the why, I think.
I'm so excited that we're like 5 minutes in and we've already gotten into like 1640 Massachusetts law. Like, you are in the right place, Joshua. I would say that it's super in the woods, but it is something that I'm very fascinated by, especially like, where there's tons of communities right up here that are, they have a high school district and an elementary school district, even towns that like are, again, aren't that big. And I always wonder, how did that happen? And of course, everyone is trying to, or there are a lot of people that are like, how do we capture maybe some of the things about those one room schoolhouse models that did work well? How can we get multiple grade levels in the same room in those ways? Which is always fascinating to come at that, but through a modern lens.
Yeah. I think there are principles that transcend time, right? And I feel like that to some degree that almost goes without saying, but there really are. Good teaching is good teaching at the end of the day. And I don't think that there's anything that replaces good teaching. I think sometimes I get taken for a trip a little bit, maybe by a vendor or some product that's out there. But genuinely, bottom line, at the end of the day, there's nothing that replaces good teaching. And I think that speaks kind of one room schoolhouses. And one of my favorite things to do, right, as I think about that history and I think about the start of school this year, is we get all of our staff and faculty together from our, we have basically five K-8s and a high school. So from six different campuses, get all those people together. And the thing I like to start off the school year and ask is a few different questions, but one, who's the kid that you love the most? And everybody, whether you have children immediately of your own, everybody has a child they love the most. And so you think, okay, who is that kid? Just think about that kid. And then my very next question is this school good enough for them? Is this bus good enough for them? Is this classroom good enough for them? Is this team good enough for them? Is our cafeteria service good enough for the kid you love the most? And it really just becomes this litmus test for what it is that we're doing in education, no matter where we're at in the state of Illinois, if that's kind of our driving force, I think, right? It's just a level set. Well, one of the interesting things, I think, is in June and July, what does every third grade mom want in June and July? And I always like to ask audiences this question whenever I get the opportunity to go out and meet with other people. And here's one of the major things that every third grade mom wants in June and July. They want their kid to have the best third grade teacher, right? Yes. It's funny to some degree. It's serious, but it's also entertaining because, like, if there's, you know, I don't know, depending on the size of your district, maybe there's three third grade teachers, maybe there's 20 third grade teachers, but every mom has a thought on who the best one is, and that's where they want the kid that they love the most to be. They want that kid in that third grade teacher's classroom. And so, right, if we in school world are leading and teaching and working and thinking and making decisions through this lens of what do I want, is this good enough for the kid that I love the most, I think it's a really good trajectory. Another little question, and I always say this, here's my annual back to school quiz that I give to all of our employees. I'll say, hey, who won the Super Bowl in 2023? And, you know, it's like, just raise your hand, you know, be a bunch of us in a big auditorium, raise your hand if you know who won the Super Bowl in 2023. Like, if I'm lucky, it's not one, less than 1% of hands go up, right? I mean, there's single digit hands here going up. I'll say, well, who won the NBA championship in, 5 years ago? less than single digit hands go up. You know, just ask some of these questions that we as a society, we get super excited about some of these things. They're headlines in every paper on every newscast, right? And then I kind of end with this question. I say, raise your hand if you can tell me the name of your first grade teacher. Do you know what percentage of hands go up when I ask that question?
100?
100%, right? Like everybody can tell you the name of their first grade teacher. I mean, you think about that, and you think about that illustration alone just splashes in a real big way the significance of what our educators do around the state of Illinois and around our country every single day. It's a big deal. It's a really big deal.
It's heavy too, right? To really consider the weight and the importance of that and the kind of influence that you can have on people, you know, even some things that you might, you know, you're doing class, you have, you know, five shows a day, every day, you never know what you're going to say. It's going to be the one that sticks with someone for the next 60 years. It's heavy.
Yeah, it really is. And several years ago, I had the opportunity to go to Haiti, the country of Haiti, and it's very difficult to get there right now, just with kind of the ebb and flow of unrest, and I'm sick that I can't be there. But it ended up the first time I was ever able to go. Went with a group, was standing in a school, and I'm a skeptically minded person just by default. Probably shouldn't be that way, but am to some degree. So I'm visiting with a principal, and interesting thing about a school in Haiti, right, or anything in Haiti really, that they tend to build like a cinder block wall, like 10 foot tall, around the yard of whatever it is, right? And then they build within this yard, you know, a mud thatch house or some kind of structure, right? Very poorly built just because of the resources that are available, not to their fault at all. Quite impressive craftsmanship considering the ingredients that they have access to. But I was standing in one of those settings, thatch roof school, no walls around the school, teachers teaching the kids. I'm standing there with the principal. I'm asking the principal like endless questions. He's got to be super annoyed with me very quickly, I'm sure. You know, like, oh my gosh, who's this guy? Get him out of here. Principal's name's Oscar. Oscar and I still have contact to this day, actually. And that was pre-earthquake in Haiti, so pre-2010. And so I was asking him many questions and just speaking to the weight of it, right? Asking so many questions. And so I noticed some kids, their heads hanging over this really tall wall. They're on the outside of it. Their heads hanging over. They're leaning in over the wall. And they clearly had to stack stuff up on the exterior of this, you know, kind of perimeter wall to lean in. And I said, Oscar, who are those kids? And he says, Josh, those are the village kids. And I'm like, well, Oscar, I've heard of the village people, but I haven't heard of the village kids. And he didn't get the joke. And so, you know, I'm like, what do you mean village kids? I don't understand what you mean. And he said, well, those are the kids who want to go to school, but they can't. And I'm like, huh? What do you mean want to go to school, but they can't? Like, this is a totally foreign concept to me. I wasn't school's biggest fan as a child, I'll confess to you, but obviously went because that was the expectation. And did okay. Wasn't the, you know, the strongest student ever, but never had entertained the concept of I want to go to school but I can't. And so I said, Oscar, I don't understand. What do you mean? Explain this to me. He goes, well, our school's full, so there's no room for them here, and they can't afford the school fee for the year. And I'm like, well, one, if your school's full, they just simply go down the dirt path, right? Because that's kind of where we're at, to the next school. That's how this works, right? It's not that there's not enough room. He goes, there isn't another one. I'm like, there has to be. No, there isn't another one. And I'm like, how much is the fee? And it was $21 for the whole year. I'm like, so even if we could pay the fee, there's not room for them here. He goes, yeah. So that just, you know, kind of, Peter, just one of those moments, pendulum shift moments for me that really did bring about, oh my goodness, you want to speak about the weight of education and the weight of those responsibilities, and then the weight to respond to that, right? And I've been involved there ever since, and now there is another school, and there are 397 kids that attend there starting this school year, so that they can go to school, right? And that's just a really neat story of God's grace and a lot of people coming together to say, hey, we want to serve kids in Haiti, But the word that jumped to my mind in that moment was entrusted. Entrusted. And ever since, that word weighs heavily with me, right? To say, as an educator in Illinois, right, I've been entrusted with a responsibility by the public, right? There's a public trust here that whenever the public says, and I know it's not necessarily voluntarily, but in essence, the public is saying, we're going to invest millions of dollars in an educational system, and we're going to entrust that system to provide future opportunities and equip our young people for the future. Like, that's a big deal. And certainly, I never looked at it that way before. And also, I don't just look at it through the lens of an adult who serves in the school system, but I also look back on my own childhood to go, I was also entrusted, right, with this investment by people in my community. And did I take full advantage of that? And so that's one of the things that on our first day assemblies, as I get to go out and speak with kids, I share that story with them, right? And I say, you all have been given a gift. You don't realize it because you've never lived anywhere else before, but you've been given this gift. What are you going to do with it? I mean, it's a perspective to think through, right? Of the importance of what we do collectively.
I have those thoughts all the time too about did I take full advantage of the opportunities that were given to me when I was in school? And it's difficult to have these perspectives when you are really young. So I am fascinated about, trying to impart that onto people because I think there's so many of us as adults who are like, you know what? I'd really love to learn how to play the piano, or I'd really love to learn how to speak Spanish. All of those things where you're like, oh, I wonder where I could do that in like a convenient, cost-effective way at school. But like, I didn't have that perspective that like when I'm, 30, that that's going to be really something I want to do. So trying to convey that to kids, it's a challenge, but I think it's definitely worth doing.
And I'm blown away by what you just had to say there because, right, the exact same thoughts, right? And the two exact same things. I have
Oh, those are mine
a
too. So
yeah, those are my two things. Like, if I could go back and redo anything in school, it would be learn how to play the piano, right? I have a friend who just, oh my gosh, he's unbelievable at it and took advantage of music lessons and things like that while I was in school. And he can light up a room. It's amazing.
It's magic. It's crazy.
It is. And I wish so badly, right? I would have done exactly that. And then just because of, being able to do travels and things like that, I was able to spend a few weeks in Singapore with the State Department back in July through the Fulbright program. Obviously, Spanish is not a primary language in Singapore necessarily, but as I've been able to go different places and experience educational systems in different countries, I do wish I would have taken advantage of foreign language instruction that I just didn't, right? I didn't understand at the time. And so, just like you've just said, how do you impart that to young people? I would love to do these things now that I'm in my 20s, 30s, 40s. And how do I do those conveniently and cost effectively? School, you need to put together an advertisement that is exactly that, right? There's your 30-second sound bite. And I feel like that's what we're doing all the time, right?
Right.
As educators in our community is saying, oh my gosh, there's this a plethora of amazing opportunities out there. How can you take advantage of them? And I will say this. I think in our community, and I think I see this growing around our state, I do think that message is getting out there, right? What you just put so eloquently in a great nutshell, I think that message is getting out there. I think it's permeating because I do think I see more students taking advantage of things. Like, Peter, I never thought I would see the day. Like, when I was, I just frankly, when I was in school, my mental model of high school, for example, was okay, there's a 7-period day. I've got to take 7 classes. Can I make 2 of them PE? Can I be a teacher assistant for 2 of them? Right? That means I've only got to come up with three more. And, is that math, English, and science? And so, right, we try to build this schedule that was maybe certainly not as challenging as it should have been, or me taking as big advantage of things as I should have. And I now see students who we in Vienna, we offer a period 0 and a period 8. So really that means we offer 9 class opportunities a day. And we have students, literally, you would not believe this, that they sign up for 9 classes a day every day. There are students that come in at 7 o'clock to start their day at 7 o'clock, and they don't end their day academically until 4 o'clock. which is awesome, right? That they're taking advantage of those things. It's great. We've also got CTE programs, right? That kids have to be up by 6:30 because they have to leave on a bus to get to their starting CTE class at 7:30 a.m. in another part of the county. And so I'm really impressed by our young people right now who are, right, kind of taking the bull by the horns, if you will, and saying, hey, these are huge opportunities. I want to take advantage of them, and I want to ride that into my future. So I see hope in it. I see those things happening.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the international travel that you've got to do, and that you were just in Singapore, what, a month or two ago?
Yeah, back in July, I was able to spend some time in Singapore with some folks from the State Department, the Fulbright program.
Right, the Global Schools program, correct?
Yes, yep.
What was that like? What was Singapore like?
It was great. Singapore's an interesting place. I would say, you know, as you do your podcast here and various audiences listen to it, I would encourage any teacher, administrator, right, kind of that audience here to get on Fulbright's website. It's obviously a program of the United States Congress. It's been around since, I think, the 1940s, if my memory serves me right. And part of me said, oh, my gosh, a Fulbright program would never be accessible to a person like me. Right. That's just, I mean, not on my radar as accessible. I would encourage all educators. There's a place for teachers, for administrators, for people who want to go do research, college professors. There's a program by which you can access Fulbright. I would encourage you to apply and would certainly be glad to serve as a resource in that process. So certainly as I went through that process, honestly, Peter, I thought there's not a chance, right? I mean, there's no way that I get to be involved in this and step through. It's a lengthy process. It's a lot of work. It's interviews. There's a lot of components to it. But when I was notified by the State Department that I've been selected, wow, that was amazing. And obviously a big aspect of that, right, as you've asked about, is doing some educational research in Singapore. Singapore is a long way from here, even flying, right? That's a long flight. You get over there in the world of China, India, Australia, Indonesia, you know, it's kind of centered in there for a little help geographically.
Yeah, Southeast Asia. Yeah.
Yep, Southeast Asia. There you go. So Singapore, it's a city state, right? And I think it's known all over the world. I think here's the things that people don't necessarily know about it, right? They don't know that it's only 60 years old. So they were celebrating their 60th anniversary as a country while I was there. Super cool. And so as I got to interact just of an evening time with locals, they are proud of their country. And it was really encouraging just to see the pride of country. I got to meet with a gentleman. He said, you know, I'm older than the country. I said, oh, really? He said, yeah, I'm 63. And I said, oh, you know, how'd your family wind up here? What's that story? And he said, well, we came from China. My grandfather came from China. So my grandfather, my father, and now I'm the third generation here in what is now known as Singapore. And he said, we were very poor when I was a kid. And to illustrate, right, kind of the poverty of the situation, he said, I remember one year we only had chicken twice. And he told me the exact 2 days that he had chicken in that particular year twice, right? As Singapore is just this fledgling country, island, nation. I mean, it's smaller than my school district geographically, right? So my—
Oh, no kidding, really?
Yeah. So the school district I serve in covers 350 square miles. So it's large geographically. It's the ninth largest geographically in the state of Illinois out of 852 school districts. So we cover a lot of territory, now sparsely populated. So our school district covers 350 square miles. Singapore is less than 300 miles. Their educational system is very centralized, right? Just because the geography of the country is so small. And I think sometimes here's what happens, like, for example, the NAEP results just came out, and that's kind of been all over the news. So the NAEP results came out, and in the United States, everybody's like, oh, the sky's falling because we've declined in reading and math and that type of thing. And so NAEP is an interesting animal. In the United States of America, our educational system is so decentralized, right? It goes back to that one-room schoolhouse heritage where literally every little one-room schoolhouse had its own people who ran it, whereas you go to a city like Singapore, every school is ran by the Department of Education, or they call it the Ministry of Education, for the entire country.
Yeah, like to bring this back to NAEP really quick for that. Actually, I heard a great, I think, way to describe that sort of thing when all that news is coming out. I think it was actually a report from someone at NPR where they were like, judging the nation's NAEP score is like getting a weather forecast for the entire United States and being like, it's 60 degrees in the United States. And you're like, yeah, if you like, it's 30 here, it's 90 here, it's 45, it's raining here. So like, maybe that's useful for something, but it's missing a lot of context, or not at all, right?
and not to digress too far into the NAEP thing, right, Peter, but just real quick, here's what I love to ask people whenever you're at every, and it's not even every year that NAEP's administered. So let me, here's what I love to ask people about NAEP. What was your NAEP score when you were in school? What'd you get on the NEAP? Do you remember?
No.
Do you want to know what mine was?
I'd love to.
Okay. I can't tell you because I didn't take it. And the reason you can't tell me what your score was is because you didn't take the NAEP. Like, yeah. And you go, well, Josh, but the nation's judged on that, right? We get compared to other nations based on this NAEP score. And here we sit, right? I mean, obviously, two people who are engaged in educational things, and neither one of us know what our NAEP score is because neither one of us took the NAEP. And so when you dig into the NAEP and how it works and how it's administered, you would be hard pressed to find someone that has taken it. Because do you know in the 2024 administration, which is the data we're talking about in 2025, do you know how many students at the 12th grade level took the NAEP test?
Tell me.
I think it was 13,000 on math and 24,000 on reading out of the entire nation took the NAEP test at the 12th grade level. Do you know how many seniors there were in 2024 in the nation approximately?
Give it to me.
3.5 million. So the sample size is ridiculous, right? I mean, when you look at that sample size of how many students took the NAEP in 2024 and how many seniors, right? And it's third, eighth, and three, eight, and 12. That sample size doesn't work real well. And so then when you start trying to find someone who actually took it, it's really hard to find anybody who took it. And I apologize, the reading was around 19,300 12th graders took the reading is the number there. So the sample size is super low. And then you say, okay, well, who are the students in your school district, right, in your community who took the NAEP test in 2024? Do you know how many students in the Vina School District took the NAEP in 2024?
How many?
Zero. None. Right? We didn't have a kid take it. And so it's like, how do we judge an entire nation? And right, these narratives go out. And I think it's super detrimental, to be honest with you.
It's why I do not cover these types of things on the show or in general. I don't understand the use of it. I know people just love to have a number. They want so bad for us to be able to distill down the value of like education or how well a child's doing into one number. But I'm like, sorry, that's just not how this works.
Yeah, it doesn't. And even if you got into some assessment, like we have statewide accountability tests or assessments in the state of Illinois, because, right, you go back to No Child Left Behind, it's kind of rooted in that, right? These accountability systems, that is still, to your point, just a single test on a single day that we're somehow going to judge the results of this individual kid. Well, no, there's way more to that human being than one test given on one day and one number. So I apologize that I digress into NAEP a little bit. But Singapore was awesome. Really enjoyed Singapore. They have a centralized education system doing a lot of really innovative, interesting things. And was able to learn from as well as share with their Ministry of Education that runs education in the entire nation and bring back best practices here to the United States.
What could you bring back?
So several things I brought back. One of the things that I brought back is our deans are now working on peer observations, right? It was a blast for me, Peter, to be able to walk into classrooms and watch teachers teach. And I know that sounds like such a simple statement, but I loved walking in classrooms and watching teachers teach. And so one of the innovative things that they do there that seems like a no-brainer innovation, but right, we just kind of get wrapped up in the minutia of what we do in any given setting, right? That's not just the United States, but anywhere, is we think, okay, I don't have time to stop and sharpen the saw, if you will, or I can't access the resource to sharpen my saw. And so one of the things I brought back is peer observation. So all of the teachers in our system are literally, it's not taking a bunch of time out of their schedule, right? That they take one of their preps out of the whole school year, take one prep, and they get paid for that prep to go do this in case they have to catch up on something after school, and they go watch another teacher teach in the same building. And right, you think, okay, well, what benefit in there? What is the benefit there? Well, it's the exchange of professionals exchanging ideas, right? It's that exchange of professional best practice. And if I get to go watch someone who does what I do, I can go, oh, that's an interesting approach. I'd never thought about that before. So that's one thing that I've brought back.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something that, again, people don't necessarily realize because there isn't a, like, product that you can compare yourself to in the building, right? Like, as an education journalist, I could be like, oh, there are other people who do education journalism. Let's see, you know, people who are in similar markets or doing similar work. And I could say, okay, well, I should check that out and, you know, see if there's some ideas I can take from that, see if there's some best practices I can grab from that. But if you're just, you know, a teacher, you're doing the work all day. There's not a lot of time to actually go, you know, next door and be like, oh, I wonder how they're doing things. You could talk about it afterwards, but that's not the same thing as actually seeing it in action.
Yeah, and I think that's the fault of the administrators, right? And right, I can blame the administrators because I am one. It's That's just a simple hurdle that I should have removed for our teachers to give them the access to do that, right? There's a building full of experts that are professionals at what they do. Let's let the experts watch the experts and learn from them. Not that there's anything bad about going to a PD somewhere else. I think that those things are good, but good grief, you've got a building full of experts. Let them learn from each other. Let them watch each other. And so that was really a fun thing. I think another thing I brought back from Singapore is that every place is going to be different, but how do you honor and respect the heritage of a place that's kind of a melting pot there in Southeast Asia to some degree?
Right.
Because the country's been there for 60 years. is anybody, you know, Singaporean longer than 60 years? Well, you know, you're coming from a lot of different neighboring countries in that region. And it's so fun to go to a school to where we're honoring and celebrating these different heritages and these different nationalities. And so I really enjoyed that too, while at the same time trying to preserve and build, it's preserve, right? But it's also build this national identity that they're all a part of. And so I think that that's another thing that I brought back here to say, how do we have more exposure for our students? And that's one of the interesting things about Illinois. You have some communities that have a lot of diversity, of national origin, of ethnicity, of a variety of things. And then you have some communities that just don't have a lot of exposure to that. And I think, well, how do we serve all the kids in this setting? And so I think exchange programs are really important in that. We had a young man just come back from Germany. I was able to sit down and visit with him last week about his full year of exchange in Germany from Vienna. And then we're always trying to beat the bushes for host families to host exchange students here in Johnson County as well, which has been a great process of exposure and understanding and humanization of the entire rest of the world for our kids and our adults in our community. So lots of fun things are coming out of that.
We talked about teachers getting to watch other teachers teach in the building. I'm curious for you as a superintendent, now that you're an administrator, like how often do you get the chance to be in classrooms? Are you in classrooms every day?
So I used to be, and I that had kind of disappeared out of my life for a number of years, just to completely be in full disclosure. And not because I don't try to be in a school building, not because I don't try to interact with kids. One of my favorite things to do with kids is walk through a cafeteria, and it shocks them all to death. Is I'll just walk up and be like, "Hey, how you doing?" You know, as they're sitting there having lunch, and I'll just reach around their shoulder and grab whatever they're eating off their plate, and I'll just start eating off their plate. And it's like, you should see the facial reactions, Peter, as I do some of this stuff. Today I got to be in a school cafeteria and somebody had strawberries. Now they looked great. And I'll tell you, they tasted great. but the poor young lady and her friends, the poor young lady who had the strawberries, she didn't even see me come and got her strawberry, and her friends are like, "Are you allowed to do that?" And so So I try to be intentional in those interactions, but in full disclosure to your question, I'd kind of gotten out of this habit of being in classrooms. And so getting back from Singapore, that's one of the first things I said to our office staff is, on my calendar, because if it doesn't land on a calendar, right, kind of the life of an administrator is it's just got to be on the calendar to get you there. Put on, we are going to sit down and we are going to make sure I get into two classrooms a month, some way, somewhere, somehow. And so we've started that process. And I'm inspired, right? And it's things I know, but I get out of touch with that. And I think it's so vitally important not to get out of touch with it. And so I really appreciate Singapore in that way, that it just kind of brought me back to reality of the major importance to do it. So yeah, I'm back in classrooms now after an absence for a few years.
Yeah, you know, I one of the reasons I asked too is that I feel like, you know, all of us, you know, most of us have had, we go to school, we have superintendents, we're maybe aware of them, maybe we've met them, maybe we've had them, take a strawberry off our plate a couple times. But like, I still don't think that even a lot of people who pay attention to education may not know exactly what the superintendent does and like what that day-to-day actually looks like. Are there things that are just like a part of your workflow that you think people maybe don't realize who aren't in this every day?
Yeah, I definitely think so, right? Because I think that changes from community to community too, what those perceptions are. Because I've got colleagues all over the nation, and it's fun to interact with them. And like, what are the expectations of your community versus what are the expectations of your community? And right, I think some people have an expectation, right, they're really kind of a principal, right? They have that view of, well, superintendent's a principal, just maybe in charge of the principals or something.
Right, yeah.
It's almost hidden behind the curtain. And I think it's important that we have an accurate view of know your role, play your role. Because I see some people, I don't care what your role is, if you don't know your role and you're not playing your role, then as a whole, we're not getting served well as a community. If I'm outside of my lane, I'm not serving my community well. And so, you know, here's kind of how I look at it. I think it's really important to look at it this way. You think of any given community in the state of Illinois, especially downstate, the biggest employer in a lot of our small towns, it's the public school system, right? In Johnson County, the public school system isn't the number one biggest employer because we have two state penitentiaries in our county. And so the two state penitentiaries are our number one biggest employer, interestingly enough. But with the exception of that, the school system is the biggest employer. And so there is this also reality of it's a business. And as much as I that feels uncomfortable to say it.
Right, because you're not necessarily, you're not trying to get, profit from it.
Yeah. And there's two different versions, right?
Is
it a profit-driven business or is it a mission-driven organization? And right. Even a mission-driven organization has these aspects to it that are business. You've got to pay the light bill. You've got to have facilities. You've got to have buses. You got to do these things.
I think a couple years ago when I first started covering education, I was interviewing the president of a community college up in Northern Illinois. And they said, Peter, just because we're nonprofit doesn't mean we're for loss. You know.
Well, and here's who owns this business. Here's the reality of the business that I've been entrusted to run. Here's who owns it. The taxpayers in this community. That's who owns the school in this community, the taxpayers in this community. And the owners of this school, they elect a board of directors that we call the Board of Education. Right. And that board of directors, in essence, represents the owners. And then the board of directors hires a CEO. And they say, dear CEO, we want these results for our business, right? And I hate to boil it down to that, but sometimes you do have to boil it down to that to say the owners of the school system should see a return on their investment because they're investing pretty wildly in this enterprise, right? I mean, you look at property tax collections across the state of Illinois. Property taxes are a big debate all over the state of Illinois. I am a property taxpayer in the state of Illinois. I get it. And we should expect a return on that investment. And so I think sometimes we disconnect that a little bit, but ultimately bottom line, at the end of the day, we call it boards of education and superintendents, right? If we were going to look at a business model, it's boards of directors who represent owners, who hire CEOs to say, these are our expected outcomes. And I think it's good for the taxpayers of our communities to have high expectation outcomes for the investment they're making. And frankly, I think they should have higher expectations than any for-profit business on the face of the planet, right? When you think about what any school district or system is doing in your community, I think it's the most important thing that any community does collectively, right? There's a lot of important things that happen in every community all around our state every single day, but collectively, a community coming together, I think it's the most important collective work a community does. And so, what's our expectation for that? How do we drive those results? What do those expectations look like? And we have to have high standards and high expectations. So, the role of a superintendent, right, is really to be, in my mind, the lead servant of the entire system. A lot of I have a visual brain, and a lot of people think of like an organizational chart. If you were to go to our website for our school system, you would find this really weird organizational chart because people traditionally are used to this organizational chart where like the CEO's at the top, right? The board of directors are here, and then the CEO's there, and then it's the employees, and it's just this I don't want to say archaic, but I'm going to say archaic org chart, right? So if you look at the org chart for our school system, it's kind of the bullseye model, if you will, and at the center of the whole thing. Do you know what's at the center of the whole thing?
Students.
Students. You got it. You know it, right? Because that's what should be at the center of this thing. Do you know where the dang CEO slash superintendent role falls? Way the heck out here. Way the heck out here. Because my role, I'm not the center of the show here. I'm the guy who's around the perimeter of it all, right? Saying, okay, how do we make sure that hurdles are removed so that teachers can be rock stars? Because teachers go to school for 4 years, they train to be professionals, they should be treated like they're professionals, and they shouldn't have to worry about outside forces coming in to interrupt the classroom or hurdles be put in their way. So, right, I view my guy as myself as being the guy who's the hedge around this system that start with kids at the center so that everybody else that echoes out from that, right, ripples out from that, is enabled and empowered and equipped to do the best they can to serve kids. And right, that board of directors is even further out. The board of education is that next circle out. And then the owners of the system are the next circle out. And so, sorry for my soapbox there a little bit,
No.
but I view that as the role of a superintendent. You're the lead servant of the whole thing.
One interesting thing I think about your background too is that in your district, like in Vienna, you have kind of been every part of that bullseye board, right?
Yeah. So
Because you grew up in this district.
Just a few years ago, just a few years ago, not many. I started in kindergarten here. I don't think we had pre-K at the time, but we did have kindergarten. So yeah, I'm born and raised in this community. My great grandfather, 7 generations ago, was the founder of the county before Illinois was a state, right? So my family's been here a long time. So I've really been blessed to born and raised here, was a student at Vienna Grade School, student at Vienna High School, student at the local community college, and I'm a product of all of this. And so I know these people know me, I am these people, right, in essence. And so never had any intention, Peter, of going into education. Kind of interesting, right? My undergrad's in business administration. And so that trajectory is intriguing. My family's agribusiness background, and just kind of thought, well, that's I'm gonna go into that, run one of the businesses there, and do that kind of thing. Still, I'm involved to some degree in those things, but it was actually the thatched roof schoolhouse in Haiti that changed my trajectory to say, wait a minute, Josh, what are you doing here? Like,
Oh,
what are
so
you
you
doing
weren't
with your
teaching at the
life?
time.
No, I wasn't. This has been a long time ago. This has been a long time ago. And so it was pre-earthquake in Haiti. So a lot of people kind of have that as a landmark on a timeline for anything Haiti. And that was one of those pivotal moments that it was a paradigm shift for me to say, this is something I need to be a part of. This has meaning. This has purpose. This is a direction I need to go. And I came back as I was working on an undergrad in business administration, get a call from the school superintendent at the time in the community. And she says, hey, we need somebody to be our technology guy. Can you do that? And I'm like, Well, one, why me? And two, like, you realize I have no training in this. Like, I'm not telling you no, but is this the
How'd you get
door
that from
that's
business administration?
Is this the door opening that I need to walk through after this experience? And I did, right? I mean, I did, and went from being the technology coordinator for the district to being the curriculum director for the district, which is a wild jump, to being the business manager, to being the school superintendent. And so it's been a weird journey. Mine is not a traditional journey at all. But I've enjoyed every moment of it, and have had fantastic mentors, and really have just relied a great deal on the collective expertise of people who have done this for years, right? My first grade teacher, have had multiple discussions with her. She's still living today, is in great health, and have sought her out for advice. Mrs. Shope, have sought her out for advice on multiple occasions, and have the utmost respect for her. And I could give you name after name of educator that they were my teachers, right? That was my athletic director that I learned the chain of command from. And I have so much respect for him to this day. And so it's been a lot of fun to continue to get to serve here and also be a product of here.
That is one of the questions that we always ask, is about the teachers who immediately come to mind when you think about the folks who've inspired you.
How much more time do we have? That's a long list. I think of Nick Osborne, Dr. Osborne, who's from just north of here, which is still in deep, deep, deep southern Illinois, a town called Mount Vernon. Dr. Osborne is another mentor that I reach out to all the time. He was one of my college professors, an inspiring man of just humble stature. Right. I don't know if those two words work together, but they work together to describe Dr. Nick Osborne. And I've been on the phone with him multiple times throughout my career, have been to sit down to lunch and dinner with him multiple times to seek him out, to say, what would you do in this situation? How would you navigate this? And right in that region of Illinois, honestly, if you mentioned that name, everybody knows him because he's been that guy. And like I say, that's a long list. I think of Dr. Dave Bartz, who was another one of my college professors, who same experience I've had with Dr. Bartz, an inspiration, and somebody that I lean on a great deal. I think about Joan Clayton, who was high school business teacher, right? Here I was in high school, a kid that's going to go get an undergrad business administration. And Joan Clayton was a rock through my high school experience that was inspiring in so many ways, and didn't just teach me about accounting and best business practices and those type of things, but taught me how to be a good human, right? It was so much more of a meaningful connection and experience than just, here's an accounting book, let's figure this out, right?
Right. Again, those are the things that you remember is about how to be a person.
Very much. So that list is just never ending. The inspiration of prior educators in my life, and that still do that today, that still serve in that capacity today.
We talked about how you grew up in this community. You know this school district is probably as about as well as anybody. And so I was just curious again, for people who are coming from elsewhere in the state that just don't know much about Vienna, just what's a few of your just favorite little things about the district?
It's a long list of favorite things that I have about the area that I live in. I'll tell you, here's something that I think that most Illinoisans don't necessarily realize about Illinois. There are rocks and hills and creeks and bluffs and rivers and trees, and it's beautiful. And not that the prairie part of Illinois isn't beautiful. It is beautiful as well. Like, I mean, there's something majestic about driving through the prairie state, right? And watching the amber waves of grain, if you will, right? That's inspiring. And when you get down into the Vienna region, the Shawnee Forest Country part of Illinois, it is magnificent. And so that in general, right? And could spend days there talking about that. I would say also, right, specific to the school district, and not just the natural beauty of the region, would be Vianna, just great kids, great families, great teachers. It really ultimately, bottom line at the end of the day, is about people. And we don't have the newest buildings in the state when it comes to school facilities. Like in our high school facility, part of it is from 1920. I kid you not, right? It's like, that's
older
crazy.
Than Singapore.
Older than Singapore. It's older than Singapore. Parts of that building are older than Singapore. So it's wild. And but there's magic that happens in those halls every single day, and it's the people. And I think that culture and climate in schools is wildly important. And I think, right, if you look at schools across the state, you say, well, how do you even measure that? How do you get that feedback? What does that look like? And the University of Chicago has done a really nice job of putting together a five essentials survey. And I think that we've utilized that tool to drive culture and climate improvements and gains in Vianna. And I think if you were to come here in person, you would see it, you would experience, you would witness it. Another unique thing about Vianna is that we offer over 200 dual credit college level credits on our high school master schedule. You and I have talked about that, Peter, previously.
That was my next question. You just got to it before I could ask you. Yeah.
Okay. And right. That's a really unique thing about Vianna. And we've been a very active voice in state policy for years in that space. And so on any given year, we will have 10 to 17% of our senior class, I think maybe this year, maybe more than 17% based on some preliminary data I've heard, graduate with their associate's degree. And here's the wild thing about dual credit and early college programming in our high schools across the state and in Vianna is it changes a mindset, right? We've got a lot of young people in our state who are saying, am I college material, right? While they're in that junior high school experience, a question every single one of them asks themselves, am I college material? Here's what dual credit does. Here's what early college programming does. It gives them the opportunity to take a class, two classes, a half a dozen classes while they're in high school. And guess what? All of a sudden that am I goes to I am, right? It's the same two words in a different order. And it changes the trajectory of young people's lives and their future. And it's wild, in my opinion, right? And I've watched it have these wild implications of being life-changing, trajectory-changing. And so I think that's unique about Vianna. And we certainly see dual credit early college programming growing all over the state, all over the nation. But I'm so glad that that's something we started here over 15 years ago. And that's one thing I think is unique and I really enjoy about Vianna, too, is that type of approach to education.
And you talked about climate and culture, right? And that fits under, I think, the larger umbrella of like school safety, right? Because a part of safety is, you know, feeling comfortable and confident being in the classroom. I also want to ask on a different part of that school safety thing. What did becoming a sworn certified law enforcement officer teach you about that?
Well, that's an interesting journey too, right? So I'm probably one of the, there actually are, well, there were four of us. There were four school administrators that I know of in the state that had became sworn certified law enforcement officers. And I'm one of the four that I know. Two of them have retired at this point. So right now, as far as I know, that leaves two of us that are active school administrators that are sworn certified law enforcement officers. And I know that's kind of a wild, crazy thing. Like, oh my gosh, how did you have time to go through the Illinois Police and Training Academy, right? I mean, I went through the Illinois Police Academy to do this.
Yeah, how long did that take?
Yeah, it took 2 years. It was ridiculous, yeah. Right? And so it wasn't an overnight process. I didn't just go to the local sheriff and, you know, he deputized you, right? I think that's kind of how this happens on the movies.
Yeah, very Andy Griffith-ish,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, like the Andy Griffith show. That is not reality. At all. And so I went through 2 years of the Illinois Police Academy. And so, right, it was every Saturday for 2 years because I couldn't do that during the week. So they have this, you could do it during the week, 5 days a week for so many months. Well, my job doesn't lend itself to that. So I literally went every Saturday for 2 years. And it helped. School safety is a big deal, right? So we talked at the beginning of this about the kid I love the most. Well, one of the things I want for the kid I love the most is to know that they're safe.
And that's, so might be number one. Yeah.
Might be number one. I would say it is, right? And that's a big deal. And so one aspect, I think, of overall school safety is this SRO piece, right? These school resource officers that we have out there. And I know there's a mixed bag of opinions. And really, I would say, here's my thoughts on that. It's a part. School resource officers are a part of an overall holistic school safety picture, right? School social workers are a part of an overall holistic school safety picture. And climate and culture, as you have mentioned, is a massive part of overall school safety. And so I think it was helpful for me to walk in those shoes, if you will, and I certainly do not hold myself at the same rank of officers who do this type of work every single day. I have the utmost respect for them. While I have gone through the same formal training they have, I am not the equivalent of them by my view at all. But I do think that that involvement and that training has helped me to better collaborate with the state police officers in our region, with our sheriff's department, with our police department, and to really have to serve as a translator, if you will.
Right.
if it might sound odd, but to know enough of the law enforcement language and to also kind of know the education world language to say, hey, these two things do have to work together. They do intersect. And what does that really look like?
What's just something about education you wish more people knew?
I've already said it's a gift, right? And I would probably just go back to that, Peter. I think, you know, in our societal context, we see it as compulsory public education. And I think we don't know it's a gift. And I think that that's really important. And we know it, but it's like hidden somehow. It's a gift. And take advantage of it. Oh my gosh, take advantage of it. Just like you said earlier.
Take piano. Learn Spanish.
Yes, yes, yeah, yeah. You get it. You've got the 30-second commercial that could go out about it. But that's the biggest hidden thing about education in America is that it's a gift. But we have a national narrative. It's so intriguing. We have a national narrative that says it's bad. Public education is bad. Public education is failing. Public education is it costs too much, right? We have this national narrative that, and it's not new this year, right? I mean, this national narrative has gone on for a long time, and I think sometimes we get tripped on that, and people, it steals from me when I take that national narrative. But then when I come back home and I look at it and I go, wow, like I got to see a kid today wiping off tables in a cafeteria and right from our life skills program. And he was so proud of himself, right? And I mean, this is a young person who has some intellectual disabilities, but education has given him this opportunity to show up and have purpose and have meaning. And he gets to be involved with the cafeteria staff who he adores and loves, and they love and adore him. That's a gift. And this is a young person that if I had visited the K-8 building, which I had, that he was in several years ago, he's a different kid, right? He's learned how, because of the gift of free public education, he's learned skills how to that allow him to interact in life and to be productive in life and to get to do these things in life. I got to hear from one of our principals last week. We had another group of our students who some intellectual disabilities, and they got to go across the river because, right, we're all the way down here. We're nearly in Kentucky. So they had to cross the river. They got to go to a horse farm. Now I got to ride horses. And like, it was just this phenomenal experience and smiles and laughter coming in. On Monday night of this week, I was setting our where we have our board meetings, that there was a group of kids getting off a bus at 5:30. And it was like kindergarten through eighth grade kids who had been out to one of our local camps that we partner with for after school programming. And the joy and the laughter of those kids getting off of that bus was amazing. And then the very next day, I get to cross paths with one of those families. And I said, oh, you know, what are you guys been up to? How's it going? They said, oh, we got to go out to camp. I said, well, what'd you do? They said, we got to swim. And Peter here, I mean, you think, okay, swimming's not a big deal. But here's the thing about these young people in this family. They've got really good parents, but they're young parents with young kids just starting careers and things like that. They don't have a swimming pool at home. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, that's ridiculous. They're not at a point in life where they can afford a swimming pool at home. And that kid got to swim. And so I said, you got this, that's awesome. You got to swim in like a pond or a lake. I mean, I didn't, you know, he goes, no, we got to swim in a creek. He doesn't have a creek running through his yard in a woods. He got to go swim in a creek, and that's like a core memory for that kid for the rest of his life. And so just these things that happen in our schools, there are 10,000 good things that happen in our schools every single day, and I would say don't miss them. That's the hidden thing about education.
Making core memories every day. Josh, it was an absolute pleasure. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did.
I did. Thanks for the opportunity. Have a good evening.
That was my conversation with Vienna Superintendent Joshua Stafford. Thank you so much for listening to Teacher's Lounge. As always, please feel free to nominate a teacher in your life to be on this show. It's how we get all of our great guests. Please send them our way to teacherslounge@niu.edu. Wherever you're hearing the show, please subscribe, leave us a rating, or share it with a friend so we can get even more perspectives on the show. A big thank you to the Northern Illinois band Kind Ofs for the music you hear throughout every single episode of this show. And I have been your host, Peter Medlin, and we'll be back with more Teachers Lounge very soon. See ya.